a girl sat next to me in school, Daisy Jaich, J-A-I-C-H, Jaich, explained the fact of life to me. Stanley, the teachers like you, and some of the tough guys like you, but they know you're not part of it. Like that, things like that. Really insightful things. And I didn't say a word back to her. I took it all in. I listened everywhere. As a matter of fact, she saw that I was taking her seriously, and she talked to me for probably 10 minutes like this, and filling out the details. And she was really explaining to me some of the problems I was having, what she was really talking about, and how to solve them. And so I ceased being a member of the guard force and all of that stuff in the 8th or 9th grade. And I didn't see anywhere to go. And what really happened was I became very cynical about school, not taking it seriously at all, ridiculing it. And if not in words, then my conduct really was a threat to the school. And teachers began to really go after me because I wasn't taking it seriously. And I began to make up for it through socialization with the crowd that was most socialized around dancing, and new jitterbug dancing, and the Balboa, and the Lindy, and jazz, big band jazz. That's where my creative efforts went. And then away from school. And basketball and dancing was the thing. And it was about that time that I had my first experience with the Communist Party. Jerry Voorhees was our congressman. And he was a big cooperative man and a real hard, flat-out liberal.
What do you mean cooperative man?
Well, he's in the cooperative movement. He remembered me. Years later, 30 years later, I walked up to him. He had made a speech as the head of National Co-op or something. And he remembered me just like that, boom. But the CP was really really pop-fronting it with him. And one of their women was really making a big play for him. And I looked at them, and I couldn't figure out who in the world they are. I didn't know what a communist was. But I knew what they were doing I didn't like. There was something wrong, something not real, something not sincere, something not plain talk. But manipulation was going on here in these rooms. Well, I was going to the Young Democrats Club with a buddy of mine. He had led me there. He had won the Hearst Trophy for oratory, my best buddy, Sidney Gordon. And he was a non-dancer, non-basketball player. He was totally into school. A Jewish family, mother, some sophisticated intellectual family, father, a tough truck driver. No stereotypes in that family. Well, I lost my thread.
Yeah, well, what I want to know, you said he was talking about cooperative. Now, during the Depression, was there a big movement to get people together and...
Oh, yeah. But particularly...
Work cooperatively.
Yes, but in the L.A. area, it peaked in the Compton area. In the late 1800s, abolitionist women came to Compton and formed a Looking Backward Club, Edward Bellamy. And that became later a Production for Youth Club, which then became a self-help co-op, where you would check in the morning. You'd be dispatched to a field. This is the largest agricultural yield county in the country, in the whole United States. And you'd go out and you'd pick all day long oranges. And you'd come back and there were sorters ready. And you'd go home with 6 oranges, 2 cabbages, 3 pounds of cherries, whatever was that day. And I think that the book Southern California Country, written by the longtime editor of The Nation, I forgot. Yes. He has a figure in there that runs something. I can't be sure if it's accurate. That 55% of the working people in the Compton area were getting 75% of their green grocer needs. I may have that figure wrong, but that's what occurs to me at this point. And that became, those self-help clubs then became the EPIC clubs. And they were the core EPIC clubs. And that's a real bit of continuity for the L.A. area, which we did not have in East L.A.
Did the CP in any way try to plug into those cooperative-type movements?
Not to my experience, because I never got that involved.
You came in contact with the CP, but through the Young Democrats?
Yes.
Because the CP, the Popular Front Woman, the CP was trying to intermingle.
And I wasn't too impressed with the end. I was impressed with Voorhees. And they got him finally out of office by gerrymandering his district. And he lost out. They gave him part of a conservative district and they cut his throat next election. But he was a hero kind of a figure for me for a while.
He was a Democrat. He
was a liberal Democrat.
What kind of part-time jobs did you have?
Oh yeah, I was a paper boy, of course, in the L.A. Post and Record, 10 cents a week, 6 days a week.
They were afternoon papers.
Yeah, and the Sunday Times and Examiner. They gave you a red wagon, not your own. You got to use that red wagon when you had those papers. They were good wagons. Steel wheels and they'd roll. And my main job, though, was a part-time job every day after school for 4 hours in a junkyard, dismantling electric light and gas meters for the various metals therein: bronze, copper, brass, aluminum, steel, cast iron, etc. And we had each one of us, it was all, they would get dumped in the back of the wrecking yard maybe 1,000 meters in the morning. And when we came from school, 6 of us, now some meters were much better than others with metal. And we was not divided. We ran and fought one another for the best meters. And then each of us had 55-gallon drums, 6 55-gallon drums in front of us, and we would sort them, dismantle and sort. And it was total dog-eat-dog. We were all friends at school and all enemies on the job. Fought on the job. Fist fights on the job between us, best friends, because of the nature of this work. And that taught me quite a bit. Because it was total misery on that job the whole time. 4 hours a day of just pulling teeth.
And the job was organized so that individual effort. You couldn't work cooperatively. Did that ever dawn on anyone to try to reorganize them later?
No. It was set up so no one ever broached the subject. Never, we knew that was out. We got paid daily in coin. Never paid us any paper. Run them, would you believe it?
So at the time now, you're going to, let's go back to UCLA. You started UCLA,
September 1940.
Yeah. Now, oh, and also, September 9th, well, you're starting in college now, and war clouds are moving in, or do you...
Yeah, oh, no, I remember in late 39 or early 40, saying to my friend Hank Garcia, who was one of my closest buddies at the time, we're walking across this big field near Ford Boulevard in East L.A. and Telegraph Road. And I said, Hank, for Christ's sake, this war in Europe has been going on for 4 years, and it's not getting smaller, it's getting bigger. And we both knew that meant us. And we thereupon began to make plans to go to South America and escape to war. Like kids will, was pure fantasy. His parents said to him they were all immigrants. His mother's whole family was from Italy and his dad was from Spain. My mother, when I approached her, said, you can get the money to get there. You can go. And his parents wouldn't give him that kind of, even that much. Go ahead. Or his brother either, Richie. And so we were on our own with that. But I mean, we knew in 39, or 40, probably 1940, after the fall of France, it was pretty clear.
Yeah, Roosevelt was not to kind of
yes,
truth.
Yes, yeah, it was pretty clear.
Were there any groups at UCLA? Was there, anti-war groups were involved in any?
Well, at Los Angeles City College, or Junior College, was a very large CP. And a number of Trotskyists. But when we were seniors, the student body president and I were sent to a conference at City College. And we didn't know what it was. We were sent by the principal.
Why were you selected to go with the student body president?
I guess they figured I was a very vocal, radical type guy. And the meeting was chaired and conducted by a young guy named Burnside, I believe his name was. There were two brothers, they were both social democrats. They were both in the YPSL, the Young People's Socialist League, Second International. And the American Students Union, ASU, had just split on the question of CP domination. Or was in the process of splitting. And well, here we were, knew nothing, and walked into this room, and he's asking us all to vote against the CP. And this is like a meeting of the ASU. And I got up and I said, hey, we just got in the door. We don't know what you're talking about. And you can't ask us to vote. And the meeting broke up. And that guy, when I got to UCLA, he hated me like, but he got me to go and help protest at the, what do you call him? Not the dean, but the provost of the campus. Protest the fact that Norman Thomas was not allowed to speak on campus. And he wound up shutting up and letting me do all the talking to the provost. For which I told him, hey. But at any rate, I knew there was a CP because of this meeting we went to as seniors. But I didn't know what that meant, really and truly. I just knew that I didn't want to participate in voting for anything that I didn't know about. And John Smart, the student body president, I saw him just the other night at the 50th reunion of my class. He felt the same way, that, you know, you don't have to vote when you don't know. Mm-hmm. Coming from out of nowhere, there's something phony going on here, getting us out here. But it was obvious that the school board, the heads of our school, were in on this with the SP. There was some kind of agreement had been reached here that we would be sent, and from a number of high schools, to an SP meeting to vote against the CP. But then at UCLA was the first time I ever saw CPUs in operation. Every football game Friday, there would be, you could sing in your 11 o'clock class football songs. It was ridiculous. And I believed it was ridiculous, I think so. But twice in my experience, CPUs tried to sing the International. And I told one guy, I said, what are you guys doing? That song you're singing sounds to me like a serious song. What are you giggling around singing that in a half-assed manner for? And he double-talked some kind of an explanation. And I couldn't see, I could never stomach them. It seemed to me that there was always some kind of something going on that we, the rest of us, didn't know about. Somehow. And,
on game days, man, I find it interesting how you're allowed to sing in your 11
o'clock. Yeah, because physics classes, everything.
Well, just during the middle class, you'd be able to sing.
They could sing for the first 15 or 20 minutes.
And what, most people sing a fight song or something?
Yeah, by the rolling Pacific's golden waters, loyally stands each son and daughter, hail the emblem of our alma mater, mighty Bruin Bears, and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Jive.
How long were you at the UCLA?
Almost 3 semesters. I left before the end of the Pearl Harbor semester.
Mm-hmm. And what did you leave to do?
I went to Port Hueneme into the, what was it called then? Maritime Service Apprentice Seaman Training.
And how did you come to that decision? Did you think, well, because this college is nowhere, or did the war factor into your decision?
Well, a number of things are happening. That semester, the Pearl Harbor semester, it started in September 1941. I had a Professor Pyatt for Philosophy 2A. And he drew a temple, a Greek temple, on the blackboard the first day with 4 pillars. And he said, here are the metaphysical pillars of this temple and the material pillars. And I'm going to destroy, in my presentation for you, or attempt to do so, the metaphysical pillars. I never took a note in that class. I listened to him. I could read you from my mind practically back what he said. I was still a believer in God somehow, although not religious. And by the time I knew that this guy was wiping out my belief in God, and I didn't have anything to put in its place. And so I was in crisis in a number of ways. And after Pearl Harbor, UCLA campus was like a mental institution for young guys. Jeez, we were running around there in the most frenetic manner anyone has ever witnessed. And I had gone downtown on Spring Street to Captain, what was his name? Anyway, it was an ad in the paper, and I went and applied for the cadet corps, and then the same day went down and for apprentice seaman training. And they called me first. And in early February, I guess it was, or late January, they called me, and I went right to put my name. They didn't even have enough clothes for us. It was that early in the war. No jackets, even. Just, they gave us 6 pairs of underwear and 2 shirts, and we wore them all. On the cold mornings up there in that port, we'd get up at 5. And before I finished that training, they called me to Treasure Island, to the cadet corps. And I made a trip, the South Pacific Run, long one, returned to the United States January the 11th, 1943.
And so you joined the cadet corps.
Yeah.
And you went right to sea?
No, I was 2 months on Treasure Island, and then they put me aboard the ship as a merchant marine, naval reserve cadet. And that crew, every AB on that crew but one, five ABs, a bosun and a carpenter, seven guys were 34 strike veterans. Mm-hmm. And the first day aboard of that ship in this port, we got that Hinton R. Helper, the SS Hinton R. Helper, out of that shipyard, Cal ship down here. And first day aboard, we were down here at Outer Harbor, at the old Graceland pier, and I walked with my fellow cadet out onto the boat deck, and the deck gang was drinking coffee, standing offshore gunwale. And they looked up, and they looked at us in these khaki officers' uniforms. And I saw the look on their face, and I knew I was in the wrong church. And within a month, I was eating in their mess, living in dungarees, and was not doing any of my homework for the cadet corps studies, trig and navigation and all that. And they taught me, they saw they had a recruit. They taught me, where were you in 34? Was with how they opened with me. I said, I was in the seventh grade, sixth or seventh. And where were you in 37? 36, 37. I said, I was in the ninth, you know. But they began to teach me what happened in 34. And then they would drill me. What was the Fink book? What was continuous discharge papers?
There was one cadet.
Two cadets. But one of them was attracted to them.
Oh.
Me. And they taught me, I learned in that trip, I learned four wire splices. I learned all the manila splices. I learned at least a dozen usable knots. I learned a lot of more of marlin spike and palm and needle seamanship. And I left that ship, had found a loophole in naval reserve law, and resigned. And I had papers of introduction to Rangaval Johansson, Ringbolt Johansson, the port agent for the SUP in this port, from the bosun, saying, give this kid a trip card. This is Red Weir here. Wants to come up to the forecastle like a man. And I was in.
Your nickname was Red because of your
hair.
Your hair.
Yeah.
What did your mother think about you shipping?
She was for me being a cadet. When I phoned her up and told her I had resigned from the cadet corps, she went into shock. She really did. I mean, this was working class side of town boy making good. This was what college kids did.
Well, if you would have gone on as a cadet, then you would have become an officer of a ship?
I would have become a third mate with Naval Reserve ensign's papers. I would have wound up at King's Point to finish off after this trip that I made to sea. And I probably would have been a skipper by the end of the war, or chief mate at least. And some of them, like Henry Garcia, my buddy who we had to talk about the war, he was there. He's the one who told me about it. He was there at Treasure Island when I got there already, and the group before me, and he was on a ship that was commandeered by the Navy, and he chose to remain aboard, and he became a lieutenant in the Navy.
So that was kind of your guy, the one shot you guys might have had to make it to South America was getting on a boat.
Yeah, and well, he and I were never friends again after that because he went absolutely topside in attitudes. And he became a right winger politically. And all his family in Spain fought for the royalists.